It is Saturday, December 9th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and your calls with questions and comments about technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on the program, we're taking your calls and questions of technology during the second half of the show. During the first half of the show, we're doing News of the Week. We like to call it the Geek Week segment, Week in Geek segment, I think it is. And today, during the second half, we'll open up the phone lines to anything you'd like. Any question you have about technology, specifically about computers, feel free to call in. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us right now. Get in the queue. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Geek Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. In just a moment, we'll have Alex Leas from Los Angeles joining us as well. Sean, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning, Lyle.
So, sir, let's start with you on the Geek News since you're actually here and we're ready to go. Please. What's
okay.
Your first story?
So, Miles sent this. Miles is currently in Florida for his company doing training. But, when Miles travels, he sits in his hotel room. Instead of going out and checking the city out. Or at least that's what it seems like. Because every time I talk to him, he's in his hotel room.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, he found this story up on Slashdot that links to abcnews.com about a study in Denmark that studies cell phones and whether they cause cancer. So they tracked 420,000 Danish cell phone users, including some who have been using cell phones for up to 21 years. And then match those to phone records, their famous Danish cancer registry that tracks everybody, every citizen who has gotten the disease. And they found that cell phone callers are no more likely than anyone else to suffer from cancer.
So basically, in a large enough case study, debunks the idea that that cell phones can cause cancer.
That radio waves cause cancer.
Sean, thank you for, thanks for researching that.
And they're pretty much saying there's really no biological basis for you to be concerned about radio waves.
Great. That's wonderful. Alex Leas, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you, Lyle. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us from Los Angeles or behind the Orange County. Orange County, that is. I think with the next news story, I'll go with you, sir.
All right. Let's see. We've got criminals lately have been targeting students, tech students specifically. They're even sponsoring students to go to college and get their degree or at least get their training. So that they can then hire them and commit cyber crimes. It's kind of an interesting tactic, and organized crime has been getting quite a bit more aggressive about building up their I guess, developer base. It's kind of like the dot-com days where there was a lack of programmers. Well, they're having the same problem in the criminal world because they're all the criminal organizations are sucking up a lot of these skilled people.
How do we know that there's a whole bunch of people working for crime syndicates doing programming?
That's a good question. I guess, let's see. I'm not even sure how they actually track this sort of thing. I know that the NSA, but Secret Service is actually quite on top of this sort of thing. I remember at a convention not too long ago, they have people who are embedded into these crime organizations. One of the things they do is try and hire people, developers. A lot of it is offshore stuff because they're easy to infiltrate and get people inside of those organizations to either put holes in software or communicate possible back doors that they can get into. So they do have some insides,
some countermeasures.
A lot of the government organizations are actually getting involved.
It sounds like a sci-fi novel, basically. But Alex, what are these crime syndicates doing with these programmers? I mean, what's the basic use for this skill?
Well, in the end, it's about making money.
You don't say.
They're either going through and stealing information. A lot of it is identity theft. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's probably one of the more dominant crimes out there. It could even go down to the point of hijacking systems and, holding a company ransom if they really wanted to.
I think
information is probably the biggest thing, though.
But ransom off of DOS attacks, denial of service attacks, is a pretty common tactic.
Yeah.
We've talked about it before for gambling sites, but it's actually being done, theoretically, it's being done for a lot of companies out there that have stores.
Yep.
Somebody that controls a whole zombie net of computers can threaten a company to take their store offline unless they're paid. And, of course, their store is making, tens of thousands of dollars a day, and they're only going to ask for a couple thousand dollars, or maybe it's even, multiply that all by 10. So it's kind of a problem. And Miles has been, I don't know, Alex, if you've been abreast of the stuff about security that Miles has been kind of ranting about lately.
I've heard little bits of it, yeah.
Yeah, the basic tenet is that we have a major security problem in the net on computers, and you can see that by the amount of spam we get.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. Imagine that. But in any case, the big vendors that are doing security have threat levels of nothing. They're saying everything's fine. But in reality, there's thousands and thousands of compromised machines. Well, we should change our paradigm. We should say that's a problem. That's something we need to address. And we're not.
It's funny. We were talking about this about a week ago, remember?
Yeah.
About our machines could be zombies.
Infected.
But we would, it's kind of innocuous. It's not going to really affect you. They don't want you to be aware that they're even there.
And that's what the security companies are that they're based on. You're not losing your data. You're not losing any valuable stuff of yourself. Your machine's just being used for other means.
Right.
And so it's kind of, from an end user's perspective, it's almost doesn't matter. The only side effect
is paying more power.
You're paying for
more power use, because as your machine is used, your processor speed kicks up, which draws more power, and your energy costs increase.
It'd be fascinating to take a machine and take a look at its power consumption over a day, and then let it get infected by some of these zombies, and then look at the power consumption for a day.
It's probably like $10-$20 a year.
Yeah, you'll see something minimal, but multiply that out. That's a lot of money being stolen from consumers.
Yeah, what I think would actually hit home with people more in terms of caring about their computers being compromised and contributing to this is the fact that they are contributing to spam. I think people hate spam more than the few cents they might lose.
Yeah, unknowingly they are.
The idea that all of us are possibly contributing to the spam problem by having our machines sending spam, unbeknownst to us, that's pretty bad.
Lately, I've actually brought up the topic too at work regarding the Vista and the protections they have and how that might affect some of these botnets. And if they disappear or are greatly hurt, I'm sure these crime organizations are going to shift their focus into other areas and find other avenues of attack. So I'm kind of curious as to where that's going to be heading.
You guys, do you remember a few minutes ago, did I mention GeekSpeak supported by Santa Cruz Electronics? I don't think I did.
Well, you just did.
GeekSpeak is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Sean Cleveland. And over the phone, I have Alex Lias. Alex Lias is an application security analyst for Fidelity National Financial. And, when I mention all these companies that we're all associated with and such, I work for University of California, Santa Cruz. Of course, the companies that we work for have no attachment to this show. They might not even know we're doing it. So it's all on our own, on our onus. Is that right? Yeah. It's early. Let's go to the next news story. Thank you, Alex, for the story about security.
Let's talk about next-gen optical technologies. I love this.
We always talk about next-gen.
We talked about so many of them.
About DVD, Blu-ray.
And Blu-ray HD. And HD DVD aren't even here yet. Oh, wait, they are, but they cost like $1,000 a piece. Actually, that's not true either. The new Xbox HD DVD drive, it's an external unit that plugs into the USB port on the Xbox 360. It's $200. It actually works on PC.
How can they do that?
In fact, yeah, it's a lot of people are actually buying this and watching the HD DVD movies using this $200 HD DVD drive.
Wouldn't it be interesting if Microsoft's Xbox with this extension is the reason why we then go to a standard of HD DVD instead of Blu-ray?
Yeah, like, a lot of people are saying that you know, that could certainly happen. Although, when you look at the sell rates of that unit and HD DVD boxes, like consumer grade players that have sold, and then you compare it to the PlayStation 3 with Blu-ray, they figure they are, I think, 400,000 units of PlayStation 3 are supposed to be shipped by now, but they think that maybe it's only 100,000, but they're shooting for close to 1 million by the end of the year.
You mean
that's
like
just U.S. but worldwide?
Are you saying end of the year?
So,
end of the year meaning next 20 days kind of thing. Okay,
Shipments are probably happening right now. So I don't know. Blu-ray could really be. There could be more of those out there.
Okay, is this all you wanted to talk about? Optical, or is it something else?
Here's the thing. Everybody talks about storing terabytes on a disk, and there is a research firm that has at the University of Central Florida. Has found that they can store a terabyte using multiple lasers to record into a disk.
What kind
so
of disk?
So 1,000 gigabytes, a typical DVD.
A traditional DDR.
So the problem with the wavelength of these lights is that when you can record the data like this at this really fine, with this really fine method, but when you send a light in there to read it, it destroys the data. It's been a really tough obstacle to overcome. And they have... by using a technique that stores different color wavelengths and then uses a different color wavelength to read the data.
So one wavelength will actually damage the media and change it, and the other will just read it.
Yeah.
Okay, but are these multiple lasers that you have to have in there, are they like, you know, $50 a pop and therefore thousands of dollars?
Yeah.
You know, we talk about new technologies all the time, about data densities, you know, even like local company like Seagate does this amazing stuff with new technologies that can hold, you know, I don't know, terabyte per inch kind of thing. And we're always talking about this new storage technology. But then
companies like Seagate, they announce the technology and then they come out with the drives with the technology. So now they have perpendicular recording.
They do.
They're actually, you know, standing data up on its head.
So why are all these optical companies doing
that? I know.
That?
I really want to know. We talk about these next-gen technologies and they sound great. You know, holographic recording processes, you know.
Well, the thing is, you're quoting all these university research. That's what I normally quote on this cutting-edge stuff. Seagate's got its own research firm, and they're doing their own work, and they're in the model of selling.
Yeah.
So, of course, their time delivery. When they make their press announcement, they've already said, can we go into production?
Don't even get me started with the optical drives, though.
Yeah, anyway, so frustrating.
So motherboards now are only coming out with one parallel ATA, you know, ribbon cable attachment, which all optical drives use right now. So now you only have one. They want everybody to move towards SATA, serial ATA connectors.
Sure.
And there just aren't any serial ATA optical drives out there.
Why not?
It's a good question.
You know, Seagate should go into the market on optical drives and wipe the floor with everybody. I mean, seriously, it's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
All right. Well, thank you for that rant. That felt great. you're listening to Geek Speak. I'm going to go off to Alex. Alex, what's your next news item, sir?
All right. I know in previous shows we've mentioned the $100 laptop project.
We sure have.
And I was actually looking at an article that was discussing the true cost, and they were saying that it's going to cost almost $1,000 overall if you consider training and replacement of cost, and I mean all the little things that kind of go around the laptop. It ends up costing about $1,000 per laptop.
Okay, you're saying to the government that actually purchased these, because the infrastructure they have to put in to make it work.
About total cost,
total execution
whatever,
of it.
Whoever's paying for, you know, for these laptops, it's not just $100.
Okay, but let's say the hardware itself is $100.
Right.
Typical laptops about $1,000. So in a typical laptop, like in the U.S., if I'm going to go down to my local store and purchase it, and I'm going to bring it back home, and I've got to get training on it and learn how to use it, the driving, of course, to the store, the processing of the credit card transaction, all those things would be extra costs, right?
Exactly.
So all hardware, all stuff has extra costs that aren't actually part of the selling price.
True.
So, but I would assume that it's because these $100 laptops ideas that every child in the world will have one, that the governments that are trying to get into the digital age, if you will actually buy these things, make an industry for these that will put one in front of every child. And the entire execution of that path, you know, the training and all of that stuff would add up to $1,000 per child. I wonder
if
they've
training,
always...
What, how does that affect the country ten years from now?
It affects the country unbelievable ways.
It is a great investment.
And I would assume that the $100 laptop program has always known that there's going to be extra costs above it.
Yeah.
But the idea was to get the hardware cheap because, of course, the software is free. So there's the hardware, software, and then the training comes about. But the idea is that you're making an entire nation jump into the digital age. Now, granted, that might not actually be an intelligent thing to do if we look back in time, but it makes sense right now from my perspective.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes sense from a geek's perspective. You've got to wonder, though, that money, you know, in terms of trying to benefit the people who are in these situations, is learning about the internet really the best thing for them?
Maybe clean water might be better for them.
Exactly. You know, medicine might be a good thing,
too. Oh, come on. Longevity of life? Come on. What about going to Google and searching for stuff?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a neat idea from a tech perspective, but you got to really question, especially if we're talking about $1,000 per laptop, that economy effectively is going to be taking on. You know, can they even afford that? And if they can, you know, why don't they put that to better use?
Thank you very much, Alex, for that story about the $100 laptop.
Just think if we reduce military spending, what you could do with that money.
Oh, man. Don't get me started. All right. Mr. Cleveland.
Let's talk about solar cells. Boeing Spectral Lab has developed a new solar cell that can convert almost 41% of the sunlight that strikes it into electricity. 41%, Lyle.
That's pretty high. Isn't it been like 20% before?
That breaks the efficiency record.
Wow.
That's great. Okay, so who's doing this and when is it going to be out?
It's Boeing Spectral Lab.
Uh-huh.
Potentially, this particular solar cell could cost around $3 a watt.
I wonder if that's a good rate.
So
I don't have my solar cell.
According to CNETnews.com, the current silicon solar cell provides electricity at a rate of about $8 a watt. That's before government rebates. Of course, the goal is to bring it down to $1 a watt.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's kind of a cool advancement. That's some pretty interesting technology going on there. Researchers at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories reported that zinc, manganese, tellurium, combined with a few atoms of oxygen, could convert possibly around 45% of sunlight into electricity.
And they got 41.
There's a lot of people working on this right now.
Yeah. Wonderful. Solar technology, definitely the most appealing in a lot of ways, and it just sits there and soaks up the sun. We all like the sun. All right. Thank you very much for that story.
Yeah.
Alex, got another one for us?
Sure. Let's go a little bit back into security here. Not too long ago, there was a security vulnerability in Apple, or Mac OS X, where DMG actually DMG, for those who don't know, is the format for disk images. Basically, you can create a virtual disk and store your files inside of that. Well, that format apparently had a vulnerability which caused a crash, and it was generally believed in the security world that crashes, you know, of this nature, especially when you're talking about killing, you know, causing the system to crash, is effectively vulnerable, and that they might be able to go beyond just crashing it and running.
Because the idea being that if a machine is crashing, something in the instruction set has gone terribly awry, and that terribly awry, you theoretically could make it so it wasn't crashing the machine, but it was actually running code that the user didn't intend to run.
Correct.
It's usually
thought of in terms of buffer overflows, where they write beyond a certain, you know, space in memory, and that effectively can be code that they can put into the instruction pipeline.
So a thought to believe OS X, Macintosh OS X, pretty severe vulnerability.
Yep, and so just this last week, a researcher has gone and dug in and done a deeper analysis of the problem, and he does not believe that it actually will do anything more than just crash your system. So at this point, it just looks like a bug, and Macs are not really as vulnerable as people once thought.
Well, thank you. I wasn't even aware of the story. So the headline that I got from you this morning was Macs aren't as insecure as people thought. And I thought you had a typo in it because I'm like, what? But good to know. Speaking of Macs, I'll take a second to talk about a story, something that's happened to me recently. I got a new Intel MacBook, Intel Core Duo, got in front of me.
Core 2 Duo.
Core 2 Duo, thank you very much. It's running quite well. There's, of course, some serious problems. I use Photoshop and Adobe products, and they are still not compatible in the Macintosh environment to an Intel processor. So they're still emulating through a thing called Rosetta. But it works real snappy. The thing that was most exciting to me is normally when I upgrade machine to machine on a Macintosh, I will actually do all the transferring of the data myself. So I'll go through the library files. I'll reinstall applications. I'll do a lot of work to make my machine function again. This time I was rushed. I didn't want to do that. So in the startup process, when I first turn on a computer, by the way, the battery comes charged. Isn't that crazy? Macs actually, like, the Apple, like, charges their batteries. You can use it right out of the box. I guess they figured the cost is worth it.
Fully charged.
It seemed to be. I mean, it worked, and it was working for a while until I went, oh, I gotta power it up. So in any case, I started this new Mac, and it says, you know, do you want to migrate from an old system? And I know that the migration process is like, you know, any migration process. Windows has similar things. So I said, sure. So I put my old laptop. You boot it up and hold down the T key, which makes it a target drive, a FireWire drive. The entire hard drive becomes entire computer becomes an external hard drive, basically. Connect the two computers up with a FireWire. I walk through a couple steps of which user I want to copy over. And I do it. And it took 2 hours. I had a pretty cheap FireWire cable, so I think it was slower than it should have been. So the thing that amazes me is that even though I'm going the same operating system, right, but I'm going between two different hardware, everything's exactly the same. I haven't changed one thing other than saying migrate. All my applications work. I'm talking Perl is still installed to run my scripts to encode the show and such. The thing is working just like the old machine, and it's completely new hardware. It just took some time, and I didn't have to do anything.
Wow.
Yeah, really quite impressive.
One of the things I like most about, you know, what makes that also very easy is that they archive everything. They kind of went heavily with this Unix concept of a home directory, and
yes,
everything you own is in your home directory.
Yeah.
And that includes your preferences for all programs that you use as a user. It includes any of your files, your settings, I mean, everything.
Right.
And so you just copy your home directory over as long as you also copy the Mac attributes. And
see, and I thought it was going to be like, I thought I was going to do that, and it was going to be kind of, you know, it was going to be narrow-minded in that way. But it did a couple things. I keep my music, my music and all the shows. I've got, you know, all the archived GeekSpeak shows of 6 years or something like that, a lot of them on my computer. And I keep those actually in a different directory than my home directory. And the reason for that is that I don't really want work to have to back that up. You know, that's a lot of data, and it seems silly to have that being backed up. So I keep it in the user shared. Also, that way, if someone else is using, like my wife is on my machine with a different account, she can access my music. So my iTunes library is off in a shared location. And I thought that it wouldn't copy that. So I was going to go make the copy later, you know, later on that day to transfer the music over, and it had been copied because it looked at the preference file and found out that I was pointing to that music, and so it moved it for me.
Exactly. Well, iTunes itself had its preference file in your home directory.
Right.
And so it got transferred along, and so it knows about where your music is.
No, but I'm saying the preferences also, the migration took this shared directory in a different location and moved it as well.
Now what about applications that cost money that you had installed? Were those moved to?
They still work.
How's that possible?
Well, you know, Mac.
So now you've got an old system
Apple's
that has
always,
the same application.
Yes. Apple's well, always
how been, does licensing work for that?
Apple's always been pretty weak on that. Even like the Adobe products where when CS2 came out on a Windows machine, you had to register through their company and
yeah,
enable it and stuff. On a Mac, you don't. You could actually install multiple copies illegally onto multiple computers. There's less security need, and the reason for that is that there's so many less users, the companies aren't focused on the loss of money. Because, you know, 5% of their use, when they have applications that are on both platforms, it's only like 5% or less on the Macintosh that people are using. So to spend a whole bunch of time and energy to make sure that you can't copy it is not valuable to them.
Wow.
But in any case, I haven't, I'm trying to think of anything that I, yeah, everything moved over so far. The other thing that happened is all the Macintosh applications that were PowerPC, when I transferred over, the next time I did a system update after I did that, it then went and got the Intel version for me in the software update. So just the update went, oh, you have a PowerPC version of that machine, that app, move it over. The one thing that I found annoying is going to the applications directory. There's no simple way to see the PowerPC, which ones are PowerPC. So I have to do like I have to get properties on each application to see. The other thing I was amazed with, almost all my applications are universal. I didn't even know that. So I have all these, you know, freeware applications that I use all the time, and they're universal binaries. So they worked on Intel without the translation of Rosetta. In any case, the migration from Mac to Mac is very clean. I wish Windows was like that, because I also spent last night 4 or 5 hours migrating data between two Windows machines, an old one and a new one, and it still doesn't have everything.
No, it is a nightmare.
So why can't they just fix that problem?
You know, I sure hope Vista addresses this.
I do too. You know, we're going to take a little break and invite people to call in with questions and comments and maybe even rants just like us. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. We'll answer anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-KUSP. You can go online if you'd like to send us email. Just click on Just go point your browser to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And I'll give you that information in just one more second, but I want to remind you that you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. My name is Lyle Troxell. I host Geek Speak every week. Sean Cleveland's also in the air room with me. And we have Alex Leas from Orange County. And, of course, Dee Dee is supporting us via AIM. And Rick Philman is awaiting your calls and questions of technology. It takes a lot of people here at every week to do the show, and I appreciate every one of them. So if you'd like to call us up, have Rick pipe you into the booth here with us, please feel free to do so with any questions or comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruzio Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruzio has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and in Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. We were talking about why Windows is so hard to migrate. Now, Sean, do you know if Vista has migration paths for users that's easier? Do you know about Vista's migration between user to user?
I don't.
Do you ever do the migration path in Windows, like the wizards, or do you do it yourself?
I just do it myself.
Yeah, me too. I mean, a lot of things work really great. I mean, at least in a Windows environment, if you base install, almost all the application settings are in Documents and Settings under that user. So like moving your Outlook file. I remember when I used to use Windows I'd use Outlook for my email client. And moving, that's just moving a file. So there's some similar things. But moving applications is quite complicated because you have to mess with the registry.
Very difficult to do. There is an application transfer wizard.
In Windows.
Yeah. In Windows. And I tried to do it once. I didn't have success. I don't think it works very well, which is why nobody recommends it.
All right. First. Oh, okay. I see. Line two is Stephen from Big Sur. Is this Stephen or Stephen?
Stephen.
Stephen, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Hey, I really appreciate it. One of the questions I had was, I've just bought a new MacBook, and I had a question about Migration Wizard, and you answered it ahead of time.
Okay, yeah, do the Migration Wizard. It's a breeze. The one thing I don't like about the Migration Wizard is that when you're dealing with users in a Macintosh OS X environment, it's a Unix environment. So the username, the actual short name, is sacrosanct, right? You can't modify that. I guess you could theoretically do some funky stuff and edit it, but you don't want to. So your home directory is all based around everything. So if you've got your name and you've always disliked that short name, and then you migrate it, when you migrate, you're going to have the exact same username. So you're not able to modify it, I don't think, in the path, at least the choice I made. So,
are you able to modify the username after the fact?
Not the short name. Mm-hmm. Not without doing some pretty funky stuff. I mean, you can modify it in... you could do some pretty funky stuff to modify it. Maybe somebody made a script to modify the short name. I'm lucky I had Lyle as my short name already, so I didn't have to modify it much. Okay, so, Stephen, what other questions do you have?
Yeah, so the question I have is around... the mail programs I'm using. You know, before I was on AOL, and I've just recently gotten high speed because we have a high speed local access in my neighborhood, and so I did just finally decide to go ahead and do that. And so I'm getting off of AOL, which I'm happy about.
Okay.
And I'm begin to use the mail program that, you know, comes with the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And having some problems. Mostly the email from AOL is bouncing over quite nicely, but I'm looking at whether options I have. I did open up a Gmail account.
Okay.
And I would like to be able to keep everything in one place on my Mac and get off of AOL, and I'm wondering if you have recommendations.
Okay, well, Gmail does offer POP, so you can actually, hey, Alex, you got some suggestions for this one?
Well, actually, I was kind of going on the same path of thinking you were, is that, I mean, if you are going to use Gmail, you can synchronize your email, because I believe it offers POP, and so you set up mail.app to, you know, to pull down mail from that.
So, you know, I got a question for you, Stephen. Where is your email now? If you moved away from AOL, are you going with a local ISP or something for email?
No, I'm still using AOL, because
so
AOL
how are you?
Now is lets me use it for free, the address.
Okay, and they're actually supplying the email box?
Well, no, then it comes through, and nothing is stored on AOL right now.
So where is it going?
It's going to my computer through the Mac Mail program and stored on my computer.
Okay. So you still have to have what's called a mail account somewhere, someplace
that's stored. That is then through AOL.
Okay. So your mail client checks the AOL and empties it from AOL.
Yes,
now,
correct.
Why are they offering that for free?
Well, I think they were losing so many people that they wanted to keep people using their
email at least.
Email addresses. Yeah. They kind of went to a model of Yahoo or Hotmail.
Sure. Who's your ISP now then?
Well, Big Sur Wireless.
Okay. So Big Sur Wireless would probably offer you mail as well.
No, they don't. This is just a wireless local neighborhood thing. He brought in T1 lines.
Gotcha.
And he's just shooting it out to people in the neighborhood that want to get it.
So what you're saying is Big Sur finally has nice broadband.
If you're in line of sight or something like that of this one person that set
is
it up.
Anybody in line of sight in Big Sur? Everything's up and down. Place. You know,
there's enough for him to pay off the T1 lines.
It's always kind of a warm thing for me when we get calls from Big Sur because you're isolated geographically quite strongly, and because of the valley situation, there's not a lot of radio going on in there. There's some AM, but KUSP is basically the FM station in Big Sur.
That's right.
And my father ran the station here at KUSP for a long time, so I remember the constant talk about the Big Sur transmitter and how important it was for the community there, and how, you know, was it worth it financially, but it's still important because we're at least serving the... So it's a...
Oh, it's great.
It's nice to always hear people call in and going, oh, yeah, it's working, and we're serving that area. But in any case, back to your question hand, I think going to Gmail would be good. Alex, I'm not sure...
Well, actually, let me rewind a sec. What is the problem or the question that's trying to be solved? I'm trying to make sure I understand this correctly.
I think, Stephen, you want to move away from AOL completely. You want to do a new email address, right?
Exactly.
You just want to forward that mail over to...
And before I was using AOL's mail program, I'd rather be using Mac's program or Entourage,
sure,
something like that, so that stays consistent and I upgrade that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm off of AOL. I'm not tied to particular servers. And I was curious what you all use for your mail programs personally.
Well, okay, so I'll tell you what I use. I use Apple Mail when I'm on my Mac, and I use Thunderbird on a Windows machine. But I use a technology called IMAP, and that makes all the mails always on the server. It's kind of similar, well, not really similar to AOL's format. But basically, I can connect from my mail from any machine as long as I set it up and see all the mail that I have. And now, the GeekSpeak mail is actually hosted on a GeekSpeak box that we have in San Jose, courtesy of GNI hosting. They're quite nice about that. And I also do the same thing with work through my work mail. So the trick here is that because it's IMAP, anytime you check it, it functions. Now, that's great and everything if you have your own server, but what I think is a wonderful solution, this is what Josh Weiss here at the station does. He's the technical support person. He also does a lot of on-air stuff. You might recognize his voice if it comes on. He uses Gmail, and he uses all these extensions in Firefox to make Gmail, the client itself, very good. And I would highly recommend going in that way.
Okay.
And that means getting a Gmail account and just starting to use Gmail as your main mail. But
yeah,
the only thing that I don't like about it is that a corporation that has a profit idea holds your mail and has all of your mail. So, Alex, what do you use?
I run my own servers, so I run IMAP like you and basically can access it from anywhere. I also have it set up so I can use my own webmail. But for this situation, I guess the first thing you want to do is find out where do you want to host your email. If you have another ISP that provides you an email account, either through how you connect to the internet or some other service that you're part of, like Google Gmail, first start with that. And then when you pick one, look for, do they support POP? And if they support IMAP, even better. And do they provide webmail access? Because that's always a plus. Gmail, I believe it, it has POP. It has web access, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I'd say go with that or, something like that, and then just set up your POP on mail.app to synchronize your email. But make sure you turn it off so it does not delete your email, if Gmail even allows that through POP access.
Yeah, it does, actually.
Okay, because make sure you turn that off, because otherwise it'll download to your computer, and you'll never be able to get to it through the web interface or anywhere else.
All right,
so it's nice to keep it on the server sometimes.
I want to go ahead and invite other people to call in with questions,
sure,
or comments on technology. The phone numbers, but stay with us, Stephen. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any questions and comments. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Now,
I do,
Stephen,
have more questions.
Yeah, the last question. Go ahead.
Sure. And this is I could keep going for a while here, so
sure,
you cut me off when it's time. So in this whole system now, I'm also trying to run this wireless and wired out to further distances,
uh-huh,
on my property. So
okay,
the house gets wireless within, and picks up with airport through everything that I need to. But there's two buildings that we'd like to have to be able to take our computers out to. And I'm looking at running Cat 5 out to those buildings and then just having some like Airport Express.
Sure, that makes sense.
You didn't have it.
All right, so what's your question?
How far can I run the Cat 5 cable before I get into trouble?
Cat 5E can go 300 feet.
And so I need to run 350 feet.
No problem. No problem.
So
what I think what you're going to want to do is run Cat 5E. That's extended. You could probably run Cat 6, but don't do that. Run Cat 5E. Run it that whole distance, and then go ahead and let it negotiate, and it will probably step down to 10 megabits or maybe 100 megabits, but that's still going to be fast enough. I think you're going to be okay at 300 feet. I've run a lot of cable all over a building at maybe 150 feet, things of that nature. I've never really pushed the envelope to like 300 feet or more, but I think you could try it out. Do you have cable that can do that?
I was looking at the cable. There's different versions. There's even versions that say you can't run vertical runs, and then there's more expensive that says this is for vertical runs. That was my other question. There's three different types.
Yeah, you don't need a vertical run unless you're really going vertical. I mean, you're going up a building.
Yeah, and in this case, I'm going in conduit, so I was going to get the indoor-outdoor.
Oh, I've heard.
FIV.
That makes sense. I would do the indoor-outdoor. You're going to go through conduit 500 feet?
350 feet.
Okay, do not run the conduit for this project. Have you already run the conduit?
No, the conduit's already in the ground.
Oh, okay. Yeah, pull it. Try it. But you know what? I do it above ground first. Why not? Try to hook it up, make sure it works above ground, and then if it's working, then you can go ahead and stuff it through that long conduit. Good luck. And I would really love to know if it worked for you.
Okay.
I just wanted to also add to that I just looked up. From what I'm seeing, Cat 5, I think 364 feet is like the theoretical max, but there are reports of people getting up to 500 feet.
There you go. Good luck.
Great.
And please do let us know how it goes, because I'd be love to know.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thanks for the program. I really appreciate what you guys are doing.
Pleasure.
Talk to you later.
All right. We've got, looks like on line one, we've got Blaze. So we'll take Blaze. But if you'd like to call with questions and comments on technology, please do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. We'll take anything you'd like. And let's go to Blaze now in Santa Cruz. Blaze, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, how's it going?
Quite well. I haven't talked to you in a while. What's going on?
Well, I've got a PC issue. I'd like to use a Norton Ghost. What the goal is here is I have some older boxes, and I want to see if I have Windows 2000 Pro on the current box that I'm using. And what I want to do is I want to make an exact duplicate, applications, everything. Just reformat one of these old drives, and I think what Ghost allows you to do is just make an image of this that's going to just be an exact replica.
Yeah.
And then just turn on the new box and see if it works with the processor it has and all that.
Well, you can make a perfect copy of the hard drive. The problem is if it's the chipset on the new board is different than what you're currently running, Windows XP may not work.
So, well, I'm not running XP. I'm running 2000 Pro, and I'm going from a newer machine to an older machine.
Yeah. So what you need to do is find out your motherboard manufacturer, and if they're both Intel motherboards.
Well, right? Yeah, actually, if you're moving it from an Intel to an AMD system, you might have an issue.
I think
2000 might work better. XP has real issues with this. But I do recall Windows 2000, it may work better for you. But the problem is the drivers that are installed for the basic operating system, they're looking for specific hardware. And there's a chance that the hardware in your older system, it may not recognize that.
What about doing the clone, putting the drive in the new machine, and then if it doesn't boot, booting from a Windows disk and just saying install and having a repair install?
That would be my second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Run that by me one more time.
So after you copy the data onto the hard drive and you put it in your old system, if that will not boot, boot off your Windows 2000 CD and try to do a repair.
Okay.
Could repair the system to see the old hardware.
Right.
Or the new hardware.
And the great thing about the repair kind of install, like the install over another install for things like this, is that the applications that are installed will probably still be working.
Yeah.
And that's probably what you're trying to save time on.
Well, yeah,
Blaze,
exactly.
Thank you so much for the call. We got an email, so thank you very much for the call, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck.
Yeah, if you have any more problems or questions, just email us. Go to geekspeak.org. go to Email the Geeks?
You know, I wanted to address that. Lots of times, you know, we all get this great email from our website. All the geeks get it. It was like 7 or 8 of us. And it's a constant flow of emails.
Oh,
and
yeah. Sometimes, we're answering emails a lot.
Sometimes we answer them effectively, and sometimes a person sits in the box because it's kind of like in between all of our expertise. We don't have a perfect solution for it.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that it's a shot in the dark. You can try emailing us. We'd love to have you, love to get the feedback. And we'll definitely attempt to do it. But if we don't, it's no... We're not a judgment on your question or anything. It's just that we're all busy and volunteering our time. So if you'd like to send us emails, questions, and comments, you're welcome to do that. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And we have a form up there to limit the amount of spam. Because if I go to our email address, then bots pick it up and then we get spam. So that's the reason why we have you fill out a form. Again, geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. You're welcome to call us with questions and comments of technology. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We have Alex Lias in Orange County. Sean Cleveland right here in the air room with me. And on the phone, answering the phone near the room, the front desk of KOSP Studios, is Rick Philman, and he's taking your calls and questions of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 831-476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And Sean, speaking of emails, we've got one, right? Richard from...
Do
you want to cover that one? Because you looked at it?
Yeah. So this is Richard from Moab.
Where's Moab? Do you know where Moab is, Sean?
I don't.
Yeah, me neither. Okay, go on.
Firefox crashes constantly. Can you recommend fixes? I'm using Windows Media Center XP Home with 1 gig of memory, Intel Core Duo, almost a brand new laptop. You know, I'm using a crazy top-of-the-line system at home because it's part of my job. And you would think that, yeah, Firefox 2 would work okay. But, you know, the problem is I think it's with Firefox 2 because it crashes on me all the time, too.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. There's a few bugs in Firefox, too, that still haven't been addressed, one of which is what I keep noticing is a major memory leak.
Yeah.
And so that fills up. I mean, if I leave it open for 24/7 for a day or two and I have requests that are kind of auto-refreshing, I literally walk in, you know, the next day at work and it tells me I'm out of memory.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at Firefox taking up almost 700, 800 megs.
Now, Alex, you're on a Windows. You're on a Macintosh, right?
Well, at work, I'm actually on Windows, but I see the same basic behavior, just not quite as extreme on my Mac.
Yeah, Sean, you should take a look at that. Look at your task manager as Firefox is running, and you'll see the memory just start crawling and climbing up and climbing up and climbing up. And I bet you anything, on the higher-end systems when we have a lot of RAM, you're going to see that happen at a RAM level instead of a cache level, if you
right,
will,
right.
more so. And therefore, the operating system is going to give more resources to Firefox.
I believe it.
Yeah. So I think that's the problem.
But also, as for crashing, review your plugins. A lot of plugins in Firefox are buggy, and with the latest 2.0 upgrade, a lot of the plugins are having problems still.
That's a good
The thing
piece of
to
advice.
Do is remove all the plugins
yeah.
and start from there and then add them. Oh, that's a good idea. And you have a lot of plugins, right, Sean?
Not a lot, but I have a few
stuff,
that I
yeah.
use, yeah.
All right, we've got some calls coming in. If you'd like to join the phone lines, the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
Something else you can do, too, is go to your... is uninstall, and then go to your program files directory, go to Mozilla Firefox, delete that directory.
Ah, good idea.
Which is safe, because actually all your settings are in another area. And then reinstall.
Good call.
That worked for me on another system. It seems to be more stable.
Where's the
now.
Location of that you can delete safely?
Program files. Your C program files directory, look for Mozilla Firefox, delete that, reinstall.
Good. Is that an uninstall first, then delete that entire folder, and then reinstall?
Well, if you do an uninstall first, you lose all your settings
and
your plugins and stuff. So actually, probably best just to delete that and then reinstall.
Files. Okay, yeah. Thank you for that. In Santa Cruz, Anthony, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
What's your question today, sir?
My question is about basically at what point am I running too many spyware protection, adware protection, antivirus programs, et cetera.
Are you on a Windows machine?
I'm on a Windows XP. And I actually
you can
called
never
it.
Run too many. No, I'm just kidding.
Well,
when it
at which point
performance.
Is the cure as bad as the disease? Because let me just tell you my story briefly here. You guys helped me out a lot a couple months ago by pointing out my computer was running slower and slower.
That's the story right there. We actually helped someone. That's headline. Call the Sentinel, somebody.
My job is done here. Take care.
And you guided me to find that my hard drive was about 92% full, got that replaced with a much larger hard drive. And initially, the thing was just running, you know, lightning fast.
Anthony,
like, this is great, fantastic.
Anthony, I hate to interrupt your flow here, but this is a perfect example. See, it's the geeks didn't actually help you. We were helping you on this call. I remember this call quite clearly. We had no idea what to do. And Rick, who answers the phones for us every week, who doesn't go on air, he sends us an email, you guys, hard drive's full. And so we're like, oh, is your hard drive full? And of course it is, and it's perfect. So it actually wasn't us helping you, just be clear. It was the show in general.
The show helped me.
Thanks. So anyway,
and basically, so it was running really, really fast until, you know, as I was reinstalling various programs and stuff, it's like, okay, this time I'm just going to bomb-proof this thing with, you know, I have Adware SE, I've got SpyBot, I've got WebRoot, SpySweeper, I've got Trend PC, Micro, PC, so on, et cetera. And as I enabled all these and installed all these programs, it began running slower and slower and slower. And it now runs fairly slowly again, not as bad as it was before I reinstalled the hard drive, but it's like I've got too many programs checking everything that's going on all the time.
Yeah.
And it takes forever to boot up.
You can have a fast processor and a ton of memory, but if you're running a lot of applications in the background, your system resources are really, you know, constrained. It will affect performance.
And that's what these things do. They scan the hard drives. They're using hard drive. They're looking in memory, actually. They actually look around the actual systems of running.
So here's what you do. You go to your start menu, go to run, and in that open line, you type msconfig.
Okay.
And msconfig is a Microsoft configuration utility. It lets you see what's running or what starts up when your computer starts up and what runs in the background. The very last tab is called startup.
Okay.
And in this tab, you will see a ton of applications, I'm guessing, that are being launched when Windows launches and run in the background.
Yes.
This is where it's safe to get rid of all of these. Now,
all of them?
Yeah. If you're on a notebook, though, a lot of these applications are to make your notebook work properly.
Like your function. I'm on a laptop.
So you got to be careful about disabling these. You can always go back and re-enable them.
Okay.
Assuming your mouse works.
Exactly. I mean, it could be for your touchpad.
To be a little conscious
about One of those is probably for your touchpad.
So what you're saying, but the thing is, let's say Anthony goes back into his machine and takes off all these things so that his performance is good again. Now he doesn't have protection. So where's the balance is the question.
That's really my question.
Yeah. So I think I have the perfect answer for you. Rick, can you tell us? basically, I don't have the answer for this. Does anyone else have the answer for this?
I mean, it's good to run a few things.
Or
you don't have to run them resident in memory all the time if you just make a point to run them every so often.
A great way to do this is whenever you're shutting down the machine, if they do have this feature of scan the system, you run it, you have it scan, and then have it shut down when it's done scanning.
I see, yeah.
So antivirus is important because it's always looking for anything that could affect your system.
Uh-huh.
And it's also checking your mail that comes in. A lot of the spyware stuff, just, you know, it runs resident only so it can run itself every now and then.
Yeah.
But it's not really filtering everything that goes on as you surf the internet.
Here's my recommendation. For someone who's relatively savvy with technology like you seem to be, and basically anybody can do this practice, get a good virus scanning software and run it. Scan your entire machine, and then have that running all the time.
All the time.
Then on the SpyBot stuff, run the SpyBot stuff. Get a whole bunch of them. Don't get paid ones, but get some good ones. We recommend. Well, you can look on our site to find them. But run that. Then don't have that running all the time. And now you change your way you use your machine. You never say okay to a dialog box that comes up. Just don't do that.
Uh-huh.
You do not use Internet Explorer as your main browser. You use Firefox even though it's buggy or Opera.
There's a couple of websites that I have to, for my work, I have to use Internet Explorer for.
Okay, because so there's actually a great plug-in, a Firefox extension, which I don't think is actually buggy, but maybe it is. And what it does, you run Firefox and you actually set up URLs in this plug-in. I can't remember the name of it. Maybe one of the geeks will tell me in a second. You set up the URLs in the plug-in, and for those websites, Firefox will actually load Internet Explorer inside a window and run that site. So you're still using Firefox, and you're only using Internet Explorer for very specific websites.
Right.
So the big thing is you're looking to limit the amount of ways people can get into your computer, and that's why I'm saying, like, you don't use Internet Explorer. You're just more careful. And then weekly, scan it. Now, if you're downloading torrents and downloading and installing applications, you're in a completely different realm, because if you're running code out there that you don't know where it's coming from, you're just in trouble. You know, you're not going to be able to solve this without doing a lot of scanning. So that I hope that helps you to some degree, Anthony.
Yeah. Can you just tell me again how would I do this through Firefox?
The extension. Anybody got the extension? Alex, do you know the extension I'm talking about?
I'm looking it up right now.
That's a Miles thing. He knows that one.
We'll post it on the show later today, GeekSpeak show today.
And your website's what again?
Geekspeak.org. That was like a marketing prompt. Thank you very much. Yeah, geekspeak.org. And thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a call from Capitola. Miguel, welcome to GeekSpeak. Miguel?
Yes.
Hi, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question today, sir?
Thank you very much. I got a new computer system, and I thought I was being clever by taking Outlook 2003's PST file and copying it over to the new computers, thinking I'd keep all of my folders and the sidebar. Unfortunately, Outlook decided now it had two sets of contacts, and now whenever I address an email, it throws up a warning window that says you no longer there are no contacts to list, but there's a drop down, and if I click on the second set of contacts, then my whole list of thousands of contacts does come up. I tried reloading or importing the contacts in, but it continues to believe that it's got two sets of contacts and the first set is empty.
Okay. Sean, you've done a lot of PST stuff. Do you know about the situation where you get multiple address books in your PST file? So, like, you've copied one over and the other address book's still there? Do you understand how that's happening?
It usually has to do with your login name for Outlook is different.
Right. Okay, so what's going on, Miguel, is that your address book's associated with your login name?
I haven't used a login with Windows XP.
Okay, there is actually one, though.
Okay, so a default.
Yeah. So what's probably happening is you're getting a copy of that address book. I mean, I get what he's saying. So if you still have access to the old machine? Miguel, do you still have access to the old machine?
I'm sorry, I have a bad telephone connection.
Do you still have access to the computer that you copied this stuff from, the older machine? Can you still run that machine?
Yes, I can. I pulled out the hard drive, but I think I still have the original hard drive.
So
I could put back in.
You can import the data from the PST.
That might be the way to go, Miguel. So take the PST that you copied from the old machine and put it somewhere else. Don't copy it itself. Then create a new account in Outlook and then go and import that PST. And it will copy all the mail and all the address books into your current PST file.
But if you want to check your profile, go to Control Panel and then go to Mail.
Okay.
And then in that Mail Control Panel directory or dialog, there's what's called Profiles.
Okay.
And that's where you can see what your profile name is.
Thank you,
Miguel, for the call. We should have you on again and talk about what you're doing because I haven't spoken with you in a year or two.
That would be terrific.
Take care, Miguel.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. I think that's going to be the last call that we take today. Unfortunately, we have some people waiting. You're welcome to give us an email. Go to geekspeak.org. Follow up on that, the way to run Internet Explorer only on some websites. The Firefox add-in, it's called an add-in, and it's at mozilla.org. IE Tab, which makes perfect sense. It's called IE Tab. That's the plugin. So you go to that site, and you install it in Firefox, and then it will be some configuration stuff. You'll have to restart Firefox, probably. So that's all about add-ons at mozilla.org for Firefox. Thanks, Sean, for looking that up. I appreciate it.
Yep.
The geeks today, we're Sean Cleveland and Alex Slias down in Orange County. And I want to thank you both very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
And Dee Dee, too, actually.
Dee Dee's really good. Go ahead,
Dee Dee was on instant message the whole time. And, she's a wealth of information. I really wish she was closer. It'd be great to have her in the air room more.
So, Sean, how do we use instant message in this environment? Explain how this works.
Well, when it works, because we all use different clients, we have different computers. Rick is in answering the phones, and he's putting the callers into the instant message so that we can see them. I'm monitoring email so that we can answer those, and we're just chatting back and forth about your calls.
Yeah,
and
every day.
Using pulling all of our expertise together.
And we'll do that again next week. Saturday mornings, 10 o'clock, right after Dr. Don. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Thank you all the geeks for doing GeekSpeak today with me. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'll be back next week.